Welcome to the Weekly on WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM Oberlin College and Community Radio. I'm Jamie Yu, and with me is Owen Anderson, and we are the news directors for WOBC this academic year. We hope you are all doing well. For today's show, we have the opinions columnist from the Oberlin Review, Reggie Goudeau. We're looking forward to talking to Reggie about his recent opinions article about racial intolerance and kneeling during the national anthem. Afterwards, we will be airing Nina Ostlander's interview with Ruth Hardy, Vermont State Senator and Oberlin alumnus, class of 1992.
So, hi, Reggie. Thank you for joining us on the Weekly. Can you introduce yourself real quick for us?
Sure. Hello, my name is Reggie Goudeau. I'm a second year at Oberlin College. I use he, him pronouns. I have an undeclared major, but I intend to do Africana studies with a journalism concentration and a minor in English or rhetoric.
And before we get to the article that you wrote for opinions, I just was wondering, like, what drew you to writing for the Review in the first place?
So I was on Student Senate from the last fall throughout the spring. I was meant to go until summer, but quit for unrelated reasons. But while, during the fall, I was approached, or like the Senate was approached as a whole and asked to, like, if anyone wanted to write an article about anything they were passionate about, just because they were looking for, like, a Senate column. And so I stepped up because I wanted to write about Black mental health. And my first piece came out within, like, a week or two after I had, like, been thinking about stuff and writing and getting in contact with Carr, who was the opinions editor at the time. So then my first piece, Being Black in a World of Darkness, came out, I think, at the end of October.
And I was wondering if your work on the Review had intersected at all with your senator job, but I suppose they were unrelated.
It started out like sort of related and unrelated. I definitely used the Review platform to talk about Senate work a decent amount of times. I had an article about the bylaws, about the racial justice work following the conservatory backlash with that flyer. I wrote an article about the flyer and just about the, you know, continued mistakes of Oberlin. So I definitely use my platform to try and intersect with Senate work a lot of times, but I've also taken time to talk about myself at other points too. Originally, this was just supposed to be a piece involving, like, my past experience with high school, and it was going to have the small contrast with Oberlin, but it wasn't, like, originally intended to be as big of a, you know, a component of the piece as it ended up being. I have like a list, a Google Doc on my phone of different article things whenever I just think of one offhand, like, hey, this would be a good thing to write about. So I've been a columnist for like a semester and some change now. But it had been sitting there for a few months now because at the end of last semester, I wanted to write a very specific article. And so I didn't end up having time for that one when I needed to smush a piece about the lost item situation for Senate work. And so, you know, I didn't end up having time last semester, so when I needed a new piece for this week and I couldn't think of anything, I went to the list, and that was there. And then it had more of an Oberlin connotation afterwards, because I thought it should not only just be more appropriate for the Review and make it an easier thing to, you know, be a story to tell, because I could talk about anything in the column, but I'm like sort of made a brand to reflect it with my work at Oberlin. And then that combined, I generally had a little bit of better experiences with communicating with admin even after I'd quit Senate. So I wanted to document those properly.
So I wanted to ask, like, you know, what made you reflect on your high school experience now rather than sooner? But I'm assuming that's, like, just because of a culmination of things that were happening at Oberlin?
Yeah, that. And so I thought that the angle was sort of last minute, honestly, where just contrasting the Oberlin experience so heavily and saying, like, this. Originally, it was just supposed to be, like, a paragraph or two at the beginning, like, Oberlin has done a lot of things that I would call mistakes, but in the end, they're not nearly as bad as these guys. And I wanted to just have that be a small part originally, but I thought it would be a more interesting angle while I was writing it. Especially because, you know, the more I wrote about the high school, especially direct experience that happened, the more likely we were to have, like, legal implications. So I was just like, this will just be generally a good thing for everyone involved if I write more about the Oberlin connotation with this.
Yeah, one of the things that you mentioned in the article was an upcoming meeting with Supervisor of Mary Church Terrell Main Library Circulation, Joseph Mayville.
Yes.
How did that go?
Oh, the meeting went very well. We rented a study room in the library, just talked for an hour. He has been working with me. I think this is the third time that we've met in person. We've gotten back and forth on updates with racial justice. He had actually contacted me around a month or two before I came over, maybe a month, I'll say, or less, and was just contacting me on LinkedIn saying that he had appreciated my column piece throughout the semester. He had apparently been reading them for a while, and just he had read the last one, A Different Approach to a New Semester, the last one for that semester, and had it particularly resonated with him, and he wanted to just talk with me over the phone to detail his experience, but what he's seen and heard from obviously friends and especially and his experience of as a sort of faculty member, the institution doesn't or can't work as effectively to fix a lot of the things and questions that I raise. Mm-hmm. And that we had first met, I think the first or second day I got back, we just walked around in Tappan Square for a while and talked about things that he we could be doing to fix it. And we agreed that he would be getting a team together of people within the administration that can have make some institutional change and or have at least some sort of influence over different departments and specifically funding. So that way if we can brainstorm what kind of tangible things we can put more resources towards or different efforts that Oberlin could be putting more different people or money towards, then that'll be a great way to try and get some permanent institutional change.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like it was a positive discussion then.
Yes. Just from that one and from the other ones we've had.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious because in this case, Joseph reached out to you first, but I didn't know that he had a peer. And I feel like maybe a lot of students might not know what a supervisor of the library does. So what would you say, how have those meetings been overall? And would you say that students should get more involved with administration here?
This has more been a specific thing for me because I have, been talking about this in the review and similar issues, that regarding Oberlin, especially regarding racial justice here, just them failing to live up to, the progressive legacy of the institution or whatever. And so it's because he had seen that theme throughout my pieces, that's why we had been talking to him, that he won. And a specific thing, I would appreciate people to get involved, I quit Senate for many reasons that I'm not going to say here. I'll save them for maybe a future article. We'll see. But if you so choose and want to make institutional change, Senate has its issues, but it is definitely one of the ways you get the most ability / easiest connections to go reach out to people, even if the process of reaching out to people can be difficult. And, for just people who aren't on there and not getting really paid to do this, me and Joseph have talked about this too, that we, I can step in and out of being involved in this while he's taking up most of the legwork and getting people together because, this shouldn't be any more on the students having to experience a lot of the nonsense and such. And especially when I'm not really getting paid anymore for meetings and stuff or similar.
Right.
So I was just I also appreciated the fact that he was self-aware enough to be receptive to that point before I had even mentioned it. But we came to an agreement on that. But other people, if you want to get involved, you're that passionate, be great. But just also take time for yourselves. Know that this should not be a thing on any of us to solve. It's just a thing I was uniquely passionate about and that I agreed to take some time out to because I'm passionate about it.
That makes a lot of sense.
So you said earlier how basically the Senate was approached by the review to if any senators wanted to write for the review, and you've sort of gravitated to the opinion section and have been expressing yourself there. Can you talk about why maybe specifically the opinion section for you?
I think that that was just like the column that naturally reflected what I was writing on, because I'd heard from, I didn't know that Carr was like opinion editor specifically. I just knew that we had a connection after the review, hearing from another Owen from Student Senate, formerly on Student Senate as well. But I wrote the piece first, just keeping in mind, like, okay, this will probably be going in the opinion section, and it makes sense because it is largely an opinion. You know, Oberlin is not, or was not at the time, doing enough to help Black student mental health, especially in my case, but just also in general. But I wanted to continue writing for the opinion section just because it felt like home. As soon as I got the first article out, I got good reception. And, you know, even though it took a few more months, or think until February when I published my next article, because Carr had reached out like over the course of like in a few months later, like, hey, do you want to be a columnist for the semester? And I agreed. And then that's how we had gotten the next string of articles.
And you mentioned you and Carr kind of just clicking instantly. So like, since you've begun writing, how has your relationship with Carr and now been as editors? Have you ever felt like you needed to mince your words or otherwise hold back when expressing your opinions?
I normally write how I feel. I've had to hold back on a few things just for either legal implications or just because to not come off too aggressive, because unfortunately that is a very real, you know, stereotype of Black males in the world, and it's, and just like the Black people, especially in writing, that, you know, we are being too harsh, or that we, you know, dull our tone. And I don't want to conform to that to most cases, but also it makes it harder for people to, for some people to hear what I'm really trying to say. Mm-hmm. So I will temper stuff accordingly. I'll say that. And with my relationship with both of them, with Carl, we were cool. I'm currently actually working for the review as the section editor for the activism section of the summer racial justice issue. So I had, you know, we're of course like working together, you know, me, him as the editor in chief, and now I'm on as the opinions editor. We all vibe pretty well. Nothing negative really. Mm-hmm. Just I enjoy working with them, and they're quick to give me feedback.
This has been The Weekly. You're listening to WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College, and Community Radio. And so you've been writing for, you know, a considerable amount of time now for the review. How do you feel that your articles have been received?
I've gotten very good reception on a lot of these pieces. I have many people just stop me on the street just now, like several just today and like yesterday, who have been like, hey, Reggie, appreciated the article, or I just read your piece, liked it. I've been posting them more on like social medias and stuff and getting generally good reception.
Mm-hmm.
And been quite happy with all of that. My conservatory flyer article, what is it? Conservatory Apology Shows Openness and Listening, I think is the title. But that actually was trending at number 2 for on the review website for a little bit, and then stayed number 3 for a few weeks after.
Well, that sounds great that everything's been well received. And earlier you were talking about, you know, sometimes having to edit yourself and everything. And I was thinking maybe that sounds a little bit counterintuitive for the opinion section, but then I remember you is very much tied to the ethical journalism.
Right. It's never been like anything I've had to edit where I've been, first off, most of the things that are suggested I don't technically have to follow unless it's a legal implication thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're mostly suggestions, so that's not really a big issue. And plus, me taking the suggestions has actually helped some of the pieces get more well-rounded, or just like me having a more like approach of trying to see everybody's side and like not just going in to attack something or to immediately think one thing, or to go with just a different angle sometimes. And those have helped many of my pieces become better. Like, examples. I had to go through a little bit of redrafts for my second piece. Like, an admin fails to, like, proactively help mental health resources, something like that. But it was meant to be a collab piece with Armand at first, but we had both written about, like, similar things but different experiences. So it was just discovered that we would be better off just writing two separate pieces entirely. And then when I wrote a little bit more than that needed to be edited, there was my sore piece that was when I had a meeting with an administrator, and I was detailing that in the piece that ended up being a significantly less large portion of the piece than I thought it would at the end of the draft. But I ended up making it work because I just talked more about what I had hoped from the meeting and what, like, Oberlin could have done better. Instead of, like, detailing more about, like, the things from the meeting that offended me. And that only ended up making the piece stronger. So I wasn't, like, not every time that a suggestion is made or that, you know, someone says change this, that it doesn't automatically mean it's censorship or bad.
Yeah, so, Reggie, you've written, like, a lot of, like, you've written a lot about a lot of topics that are really important. And you mentioned in your most recent article how they are often critical of Oberlin. And then you said that you wanted to highlight a piece in which you have been satisfied with Oberlin compared to your past experiences. I guess I just kind of wanted to know why that was, that you wanted to highlight something more positive about Oberlin now.
One, I don't want my entire legacy at the school. I don't even intend my entire legacy at the school to be just trashing in this place and, you know, nothing constructive. I, of course, say a lot of constructive things in my pieces, but just completely negative experiences, if it doesn't have to be that. If the school continuously messes up or similar, then I can't help that happening. And that's what it felt like was happening for a while with Senate, which is why we got the string of pieces we did there. Besides that, I actually, in the meeting I had with Adrian, where we had just went out to lunch and talked about things, about my past Senate experiences, about life and other things, he was asking about, like, my column and stuff. And just said, like, you know, after I was reflecting on, like, a lot of my different experiences, obviously most of them not really being positive, he was like, is there anything at Oberlin that you think you would write a good article about or something that you like? And I'm like, I don't know if there's enough to fill out a piece. And I thought about that while, like, for a second while I was looking through the drafts for, okay, what do I want to write this week? Oh, a high school piece. How can I tie this more into Oberlin? I remember this. I wanted to talk more about something positive here. And these were positive experiences, just the collective meetings I'd had with these guys.
And that is a really good point, because it is part of your legacy. Because once your articles are published, they're up there basically forever. Mm-hmm. And the Oberlin has a very extensive archive. I remember even, like, we keep issues from the 19th century. Mm-hmm. So it is very, very extensively logged. So I definitely understand where you're coming from. So more broadly, like, whether it's positive or negative experiences, why do you want to share your thoughts and opinions with the rest of campus? And what do you think they will learn or anything else?
I enjoy sharing my thoughts, not just because like I said in the piece, for as much trouble as Oberlin has put me through, I wouldn't have, without doing Senate and having so many critical things to write about, I wouldn't have found my new talent. I wouldn't have found a new life passion, thing I can major in. Because originally I was going to be STEM, but it wasn't really a field that I was fully happy in. I'll be writing more about that in a future article for the science section for the summer issue. But, I was grateful for that. And again, the positive reception of, like, many of my friends were like, Reggie, you're doing great. Love your article, or love the new piece, man. And it's just very encouraging to hear, and a thing that's needed after all of the hardships that I've outlined and gone through in many of my pieces.
And I don't know, in my experience, whenever I get to read your articles where they have some really strong critiques about, like, personal challenges you've had with Oberlin, like, I almost am, like, happy that you're able to express that and you feel confident enough to express that, because then I know that once you're heard, there's an opportunity for Oberlin to improve. And so I'm always really comforted by your articles in that way. And also I always get to learn about where Oberlin isn't putting enough attention towards, especially during a pandemic.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also really valuable to start these dialogues as well. I think something that I've noticed is that a lot of people since the pandemic, maybe initially people want to complain or talk about struggles and stuff like that. But as time went on, people just don't like to share or be vulnerable too much. And addressing these issues, it can really start very valuable dialogues of maybe this is a problem because a lot of people are actually secretly struggling with it, and how they address this and work towards more positive change. So
yeah.
I think that's very valuable.
And like you said, that you've received a lot of positive feedback on your articles. Is there any of your pieces that get received as well as you'd hoped?
Almost all of them have been positively received, but just in general, I had hoped after my mental health pieces, really my first two, that anything more would have been done visibly to be helping with student mental health. I really hadn't gotten much. I had one meeting with a faculty member before who was quote-unquote concerned with my articles. I outlined a little bit of this, I think, in my second piece, just in a brief paragraph. But, there were a white person who wanted to, talk through all of the concerns I'd written through in my first piece, obviously very concerned and upset by all of the stuff for me, and said we came up with some action items or whatever, and I was told that I would get a response back about whatever was going on within a week or two. Nothing like that happened. I didn't get another email about this. So that just was more motivation for me, okay, I need to keep going, since these guys clearly do not want to hear whatever I have to say, or at least this particular individual. And for another quick question earlier, I forgot to mention the one thing I would say people to take away about Oberlin for my pieces. I don't think I answered that. But I would just say that the core theme is that despite what I've mentioned in this new piece about Oberlin not being completely just we're not for anti-racism at all or whatever. They're obviously a lot worse, but Oberlin can be doing so much better and should be doing so much better. And I try and outline that in a lot of my pieces just because it constantly resonates when you have repeated stuff the con flyer happening just at the end of Black History Month. This wasn't years ago or a decade ago. This was months. Yes, this was months ago.
And that reminds me of a lot of a kind of theme that we've been hitting in a lot of our interviews is how in talking about Oberlin, it really prides itself on having this legacy of progressiveness and, being the first school to admit, women and people of color. But as I've been saying, it's more than just establishing that legacy, but also maintaining it and making sure that years later we can still uphold it in a positive way. Because it's more than just something that over the 1800s, it's you have to actively maintain it. And you're right in that Oberlin can be doing better. And it should be listening to its students, because the students are what make up Oberlin in a way.
And I think that's why whenever I read your articles, I find them really important, because you always outline a specific area that Oberlin can improve.
And, this whole past spring semester, we've been asking writers how it's been writing during a pandemic, but the Oberlin Review has finally moved back into the Burton basement as of last week during this recording. So I've been wondering, now that you've written during the summer semester, have you noticed any, a change in terms of being able to write the team in person versus having to write?
I can definitely get a nice sense of community coming down to the office occasionally, and just sometimes bringing my speaker if there's not already music playing, and just sitting down and writing an article or whatever work I have for that week, getting that done, and just in general being around more people, or having the option to not have to be so scared of people, that's because I'm I think the rest of the team is post 2 weeks vaccinated, so we, you know, we're mostly chilling. And that's very nice to have as just a grounding source. For actually writing, I've had like a little bit more trouble coming up with pieces off the top of my head, but I think that's mostly just because of not doing Senate anymore. Because that gave me a lot more immediate areas, like, okay, I know that for a fact that they could be doing better in this, this, or this because of these people I've had meetings with, or X or Y thing that's happened or been brought up by a student or in plenary.
Before we, like, get to our last question, Reggie, is there, like, anything, especially with your most recent article, that, like, you want to talk more about?
There was originally a much bigger part with the confrontation in, like, the office when I'd gotten called down over the loudspeaker by a full name. But I omitted part of that just for mostly for the legal reasons, but still cut it down to where you could get the point of what had happened and still the general air. You know, it only made it so that I had more room to potentially talk about other things. And again, filled out to make the piece more well-rounded, because at the end of the day, making that part longer would have only served to show the same thing of like, okay, yeah, this is horrible in comparison to Oberlin's like slightly below mediocrity in some cases. So, and that was already communicated just by the one paragraph, like, or the few paragraphs I'd had about the school.
And then I guess as a final note, is there anything else that you know?
Nothing as of now.
Okay, well, Reggie, thank you so much for your time. It's been great. Congrats again on just all of your hard work with the column and your articles this past semester. And I hope the summer goes well and that you're able.
Yeah, and thank you so much for meeting with us in person and taking the time to talk about your pieces with us.
Yes, of course. Thank you, guys.
This has been The Weekly. You're listening to WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College, and Community Radio.
And now we would like to air Nina's interview with Ruth Hardy about her political career and life during the pandemic.
Yeah, so if you could just start by giving your name, pronouns, and occupation and age, that would be great. Thanks so much.
Great. Hi, I'm Ruth Hardy. I'm 51. I cannot believe that. And my pronouns are she, her, and I am a Vermont state senator.
Great. So I guess if you wouldn't mind starting the interview with just how you got interested in local politics in the first place.
Sure. Well, I've kind of always been interested in local politics since I was in high school, and certainly at Oberlin also, but more directly here in Vermont. I became interested in local politics because I have three kids and was interested in what was going on at their school, and sort of got involved with volunteering at the school. And the first thing I did was a project where I planted 20 trees at our elementary school. And I got a lot of volunteers involved and did this sort of large community project with kids and parents and community members at our school. And it was really fun. And it sort of invigorated me and made me think, oh, I can do this. And then I have three kids, so they were little, and I was a little worried about how I was going to get involved. But our elementary school did not have a foreign language program, and I really wanted to make sure that my kids could learn a language at school and do it before high school. So I started talking to other parents, and we went and did a presentation at a school board meeting, and we showed up with all this research about how young brains learn foreign languages and how good it is for them and how it makes them better at math and et cetera. And we talked a lot. We did this whole research. We had like binders full of information. It was really definitely a Leslie Knope kind of moment where we show up at the school board meeting overprepared, and we just gave this really great presentation. And afterwards, the principal came up to me and said, you should run for school board. And so I did. I ran for school board and I got elected. And that was 12 years ago now. And I served three terms on the school board, including 5 years as chair. And then got involved in, we re structured our school boards in Vermont. And so I got really involved in that and led that effort in my community. And then along the way, I started realizing that there weren't that many women in local politics. And so I started working with the women in my community to try to get more women to run for office at the local level here in Middlebury. And while I was doing that, there was a position open at an organization called Emerge, Emerge Vermont. And I applied for that position, and it's an organization that's a national organization that recruits and trains Democratic women to run for office. And I went to an interview with former Governor Madeline Cunin, who was one of the first female governors in the country, and was super nervous. Didn't think I was going to get the job, but the next day she called to offer me the job. And so I ran that organization for 3.5 years and trained dozens and dozens of women to run for office. And then there was a seat open in my own district, a Senate seat open in 2018. The longtime senator was retiring, and she asked me to run for her seat. And I felt like I had to do it for a lot of reasons. One, because I wanted to be a good role model for my kids and for the women I trained, and say, when an opportunity arises, you should take it and jump in, even if it's a little, makes you a little nervous. It was also in 2018, so we just had 2 years of Donald Trump as president, and I felt like I had to do something to make a difference, and it seemed like this would be the best thing to do. And lastly, I thought I'd be really good at it. I was like, I will be a good senator, and I will work really hard and do really good work and make good public policy, and I should do this.
Yeah.
So I ran, and it was one of the most competitive races in the state, and I had to raise a lot of money and work really, really hard. But I won, and so now I've been in the Senate for 3 years.
Wow.
That's the whole big story.
Wow. That's great. Thank you so much for that overview. I guess I was curious more what the campaign process was like. How was raising money, and what kind of ways did you campaign for that seat?
Yeah. I was fortunate to run pre-COVID. One of the major things I did was I knocked on thousands and thousands of doors. My district is about 100 square miles. And so I knocked on a lot of doors. I represent 26 towns. I went to all of them and knocked on as many doors as I could and talked to people. And it was an amazing experience. That was my favorite thing about campaigning, was knocking on doors. And people would just invite me into their home or talk to me on their porch. And I heard a lot of stories, and I really got to know the communities by walking the roads and driving around, trying to find addresses, and really talking to people at their homes. And it was intimate, wonderful. And so that was my favorite thing. But I also did a lot of events. I made a lot of phone calls, sent tons of emails, just went all over the district as much as possible, did a lot of social media stuff, took out ads in the paper. I did radio ads. So I did pretty much everything across the spectrum. The one thing I didn't do was television ads, because it doesn't make sense for a district my size, a race my size. But I raised $40,000, which for a lot of places won't seem like a lot, but that's a lot for a Vermont Senate race. And that I did mostly by calling a lot of people and doing other types of fundraising online and via emails and via events, and just reaching out to everybody I could think of who might be able to, you know, give me $20 or $200 or whatever it was. And it was amazing. It was one of the best experiences of my life, and really invigorating and fun. It was really fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha. So I guess my next question was, what are some like bills and accomplishments, career accomplishments you're proud of, either in the Senate or the school board or any other job you've had?
Yeah. So I have spent most of my career working in education policy. I started my first job out of graduate school was working for the Wisconsin legislature, and I was a nonpartisan fiscal analyst for the Wisconsin Legislative Fiscal Bureau, and I did education policy and finance analysis, and I loved that job. It was great, and that's one of the reasons why I think I'm really good at policy work is that I sort of saw it from the staff side. So I'm proud of that work, even though it was a long time ago. Throughout my career, when I first came to Vermont, the first job I had was as the executive director of a very small nonprofit called the Open Door Clinic. It's a free clinic for anybody who didn't have health insurance. We served a lot. Addison County is a farm community, the county I live in. We served a lot of migrant farm workers. So I was proud of that job as well. And in the school board, the thing I'm most proud of is, well, we did finally get a Spanish program in our elementary school. It took a decade to do it. So sometimes it takes a long time and you have to be persistent and patient. And that was definitely one of those things. So I'm proud that we finally did that. My youngest son was able to get 1 year of Spanish before he left elementary school. So just the tail end. But mostly, more importantly, there are hundreds of other kids who can benefit from it. And then we reorganized our school district and we merged 7 school districts into 1 school district. Mm. And I led that effort. And it took a lot of work in our community to convince people and to do the analysis and the communication and the sort of organization to do that. And I'm really proud of that work as a school board member. In the Senate, I have worked on the Education Committee, the Agriculture Committee, the Health and Welfare Committee, and the Finance Committee. Mm-hmm. And I'm really proud of some of the work I've done in the Education Committee. It was the thing that I could just sort of hit the ground running because I already had done a lot of education policy. The first bill that I worked on was the bill that would require school districts to test their water for lead to make sure that students weren't drinking water with lead in it, mm-hmm. which is a toxin that really affects brain development.
That seems important.
And I was able to bring experts in from another small liberal arts college, mm-hmm. Middlebury College, who were chemistry professors to come in and testify on the bill. And so that was really fun to bring actual scientists in to talk about science policy and to bring liberal arts professors to the state house. I also have worked on bills about reproductive rights and reproductive health, and that's really important to me. We in Vermont are in the process of amending our constitution to include a clause that would guarantee reproductive liberty. And so I've worked on that bill and made sure that we have had the voices of young women heard at the throughout the course of talking about that bill or the constitutional amendment. And then this year, when the Senate passed that constitutional amendment for the second time, I gave a pretty impassioned speech on the Senate floor, the virtual floor, because we were meeting via Zoom, in honor of my mother, who took me to my first sort of pro-choice march in Washington, D.C. when I was 12. Oh, and wow. She died this past year, and so it was sort of an honor of her. So reproductive rights are something that have been important to me throughout my time, and certainly at Oberlin I did a lot of work in that area as well. So it's really nice to see something that I've worked on for my whole life kind of come to fruition in my work in the Senate. And then there are just like little bills that are not groundbreaking but are important. This year I had a bill that I worked on that passed that I was the lead sponsor on that is about libraries, public libraries. And I love libraries. And so even though this isn't a huge groundbreaking thing, it means a lot to librarians to have a bill that recognizes the work of libraries and sets up a structure for libraries to do a study that will change the course of public libraries in Vermont. And so for me to do that little bill, and it even though, like I said, it's not groundbreaking, but I've heard from so many librarians who are so grateful. And so sometimes it's paying attention to the things that other people aren't paying attention to. Hmm. And that can be almost as meaningful as the sort of big items, the sort of groundbreaking things like reproductive liberty.
Yeah.
So there's a spectrum. And I have done a lot of work on human rights issues and health access to health care and access to education, and I'm really proud of that work.
Yeah, you mentioned that you were involved in reproductive rights at Oberlin. I was just curious more broadly what kind of organizations you were involved with at Oberlin, especially because you were a government major, right? So,
right, I was a government major and a women's studies minor, and also a French minor.
Cool.
So I was involved in a lot of things at Oberlin. Like, Oberlin students are always kind of over-involved, I think.
Yep, and that stayed true.
But I did a lot of, work on reproductive liberty and was involved in the pro-choice organization. I actually don't remember what it's called. I graduated 30 years ago, and I'm sure the organization has changed its name since then. But we went to Washington for a march in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And I think it was actually in 1991 or 92, maybe the year I graduated. We went to Washington, D.C. for a march, and we also did protests and marches in Ohio as well. And Columbus, we went to Columbus a couple times. And we also had this really amazing conference where we brought in women from around the country who were working on reproductive liberty, and did it from a perspective of diversity and equity before those things were like broadly talked about anywhere except for at Oberlin. And I think this is one of the things that makes me the most proud of being an OB, and one of the things that has really stuck with me is like the conversations we're having in our country right now about diversity, equity, inclusion, civil rights. We were having those conversations at Oberlin 30 years ago. Mm. And 30 years before that, they were having those conversations. Like, those are always conversations that happen at Oberlin. And it's imperfect, and Oberlin doesn't always do it right or well. And, you know, but they do it. They take on the hard conversations and always has. And I think that's made the hard conversations for me throughout my life as a public servant easier because I've practiced at it. So anyway, we had this conference where we had African-American women and Asian-American women and women from, working class communities who are working on issues of reproductive liberty come and talk. I still have photographs in my photo album of this conference. It was in Wilder, Maine. and that was a really big deal that we did that. And it was a campus-wide conference on reproductive liberty. And really, tried to broaden out the conversation to make it so it wasn't just about middle-class white women like me.
Yeah.
And that was a real success, I think. I also was involved in the student government at Oberlin, which I know kind of has its ups and downs. OBs are a little skeptical about organized government. And that was the case when I was there for sure. And the student government hadn't been functioning very well for a number of years. And it was sort of this skeleton government that only a few people were involved in. So we had, what we call the Constitutional Congress, where we rewrote the sort of, the charter of the Oberlin student government. And I was one of the co-facilitators of that. And it was just like what you would expect, a bunch of OBs who care a lot about stuff getting together and trying to rewrite their government sort of documents and how they were going to self-govern. And it was so much fun and so much chaos and so much frustration and all of that all together. And to be the person who was co-facilitating it was also really interesting, because You know, I think one of the things that Oberlin, I was involved in the co-ops also, yeah. When I was an LEC. I don't know if that's what they're still called, but 30 years ago, loose ends coordinator,
yep,
they were
yep.
the sort of like managers of the co-op. And I was mostly in Keep, but also one winter term in Tank and then also in Baldwin. But I was the LEC when we were in Keep. And so I got a lot of training through OSCA about facilitation and learned how to facilitate a meeting. And if you can facilitate a meeting of OBs, you can facilitate any meeting because like everybody's so damn opinionated and wants their voice heard now that if you can facilitate a calm meeting of OBs, you can do it. So I learned to facilitate through my LEC work at Keep and then facilitated this Constitutional Congress, co-facilitated it. And it was just a great experience. And it's really stuck with me throughout my life about how you run a meeting effectively, how you get everybody's voices heard.
Yeah.
With a bunch of opinionated people.
Right.
On controversial topics. How can you work through those together?
Yeah. You mentioned that in the ways that Oberlin prepared you for your experience in politics, such as like having those conversations about diversity, equity, inclusion, and also like you were just saying about how to facilitate a meeting. Were there other ways that Oberlin prepared you for a career in politics, or also ways maybe it didn't prepare you for a career in politics as well?
Yeah, so I think it prepared me. I'm a good writer, and I think that's because of all the writing I had to do at Oberlin and all the professors who really hold students accountable for their writing and teach you to be good writers and good communicators. I keep a blog for my constituents, and I think it's a very good blog, and I communicate really well with my constituents because I learned to write well at Oberlin, and I've honed that throughout my career. I didn't like graduate, you know, as a really super awesome writer, but it laid this very important foundation for how you communicate. I think, you know, Oberlin helps you with a good foundation or builds on a foundation you might already have of being somebody who can really think analytically about really tough problems. And that's crucial for policymakers. The ways it didn't prepare me is, you know, I think that our world there's much more of a broad spectrum of political opinions in our country, especially now as we've kind of gone, unfortunately, more and more to the right. And Oberlin's spectrum of politics is much more skewed to the left. So I think there's somewhat of a, you know, it's somewhat of a, it's just a skewed spectrum.
Gotcha.
So that's sometimes can be shocking when you get out into the quote unquote real world and you realize, oh God, not everybody is like Obi.
Right.
Obi.
Right. Completely.
And we all knew that there. And I'm sure you all know that there now, but it still can be a little bit shocking and makes you sad.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I was also wondering maybe what advice you have along with knowing that Oberlin, you know, might not represent all political identities. What other advice maybe do you have for Oberlin students or college students in general who are interested in a career in politics?
I would say just get involved, work for a campaign, step up and run for office yourself. You're not too young to do it. I love local and state government. So, you know, if you find a place where you're going to live for, you know, at least a few years, get involved in your city or town government, and, you know, volunteer to be on a committee or run for an office. And I think it's incredibly valuable to have the voices of young people at the table, and you're not too young. You do know enough to run for office and to be involved. But if you're not ready for that, definitely get involved in a campaign, and or work for an organization that's a political organization. But even more than that, just, you know, live an interesting life. I think a lot of times students get very concerned, I certainly did, and I know others did, about making the right choices, and that every choice seems like it's going to be a big deal. And I teach a class at Middlebury College every once in a while about women in politics. And so I am in touch with a lot of my students. And I remember last year during the pandemic, one of them, you know, all of the internships fell through because of COVID, and he was very worried about what he was going to do. And I was like, look, just go work for your local ice cream stand, or, you know, go volunteer for your food shelf. And, you know, spend time reading really good books. And, you know, I think that living an interesting life is, and having experiences that diversify what you're doing, and not worrying all the time about making the right decision and making the right sort of next step, is important too. You want to make good decisions, but you also want to let your life be the life that you're living.
Right. That makes complete sense. And, you know, as a junior, I've had a lot of conversations with friends, because we're now all talking about the next step. And that's definitely good advice to keep in mind. Just let yourself live your life, and don't don't think too much about everything, the consequences, I guess. Yeah.
And there are a lot of OBs and others out there who are going through the same thing, and who you will find in your path through life. And I mean, I live on a tiny little cul-de-sac in a tiny little town. I live in a town, East Middlebury, Vermont. It has 350 people in it. And I live on a little cul-de-sac that has 8 houses on it. And the people who live next door, who just randomly moved in 10 years ago next door to us, are both OBs.
Wow.
And my husband and I are both OBs. So there are 4 OBs on our tiny little street in our tiny little town. And we have our own little, you know, like, we share chickens, and we, you know, like, throughout the pandemic, they are some of the only people that we saw all the time in person. Their son is my son's best friend, things like that. Wow. So you will find each other too. And we didn't know them at Oberlin. You know, we just, that our lives came together, and that will happen. It will happen for people who aren't from Oberlin too.
Right.
but I think that you will find your people, and you will find your way, and it will be okay.
Yeah, that's definitely a good thing to keep in mind. You talked a little bit about the pandemic in your last answer, and definitely something I've been curious about is just how your job as a state senator has changed because of COVID. And are things back a little bit more back to normal now, or is it still everything over Zoom? I was just wondering.
Yeah. So we declared a state of emergency in Vermont on March 13th, 2020, which was my 50th birthday.
Wow. I didn't know that.
And we shut everything down. And it was really dramatic. And I was at the state house. We were in session, and that whole week, just like everybody can relay that entire week back to whomever, we were there trying to figure out what to do. And by Friday, it was really clear that we needed to shut things down. So we have not been back to the state house since then. But we have been in session for much of, on and off, for much of the last year and a half. So we took a sort of immediately started a meeting by phone the next day to try to figure out what we were going to do. And it was tough because, of course, you know, we're a public body and we are governed by law, but even more importantly, we're governed by the state constitution. And there's a clause in the Vermont state constitution that says the state house doors shall always be open. And so interpreting what that means in a pandemic, when we can't be together in the state house, and the state house, like many state houses, is tiny. The rooms are tiny. It's an old building. The ventilation is terrible, and it's a public building. So we tried really hard to figure out what to do, and we ended up doing, you know, coming up with like what everybody else did, which is Zoom. With live streaming on YouTube, and we did it really well. I think we did it better than almost any other legislature in the country, and we were able to continue our work, and we were able to continue public access, and we just finished our second session via Zoom last month and passed an historic budget, $7.3 billion, which is a lot for tiny little Vermont, and buoyed by all the federal funding. So it's been both really amazing that we've been able to continue our work, but also really hard. Politics is a team sport. It's, you know, it's about relationships. It's about being together and solving tough problems, just like in a co-op. and we weren't able to be in the same room doing that. So it was really, really hard, just like it was for you all taking classes via Zoom. And, but we were trying to make state law while we were doing it. And so the stakes were fairly high. Mm. But we did a good job, I think. And, it was lonely though. I'm here by myself. You know, we turn off Zoom and I would be by myself in my room. There wasn't any, you know, talking to people in the hallways or figuring out how we're going to do things. You know, we had to do everything by text or phone or whatever. And it was much, much harder. And communication, you know, things got a little sometimes dicey because we couldn't really talk to each other. Mm. I know lobbyists were really frustrated and advocates, you know, people who wanted to tell us what they thought. So that was a little interesting. But actually, the public had more access to us, the sort of regular, quote unquote, regular public, because they could watch everything on YouTube. Every single thing we did was live streamed. So all the good, bad, and ugly of what we did was right there for the public to see, which is not usually the case. In terms of going back to normal or something, whatever normal is these days, we are sort of slowly starting to meet in person for committee meetings. I have my first in-person committee meeting next week. We are going back in session next week for a veto session to try to override some of the governor's vetoes. And that will be via Zoom still. But next session, which starts in January, we will be in person. And I'm actually on the committee that's talking about what kind of changes in our state house do we need to make it safe for COVID, although that may be less of an issue, but just sort of make it safer in general, in a healthier building to work in. And I think, like with a lot of organizations, we're trying to take this opportunity to figure out how can we do our work better and how can we address some of the issues that we haven't addressed for so long. And I have to say, I'm extremely proud of Vermont. We are the first state to reach 80% vaccination rate. We were able to lift all restrictions this week, and we have the highest vaccination rate, close to the highest rate in the world. And we've just, I think the other thing that we've done extremely well in Vermont is it hasn't been a partisan issue, hasn't been political. We have a Republican governor and a Democratic-led legislature, and we've all worked together to protect our state from COVID. And it's been a really inspiring and amazing and, you know, stressful and sad and tiring, but inspiring work.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me. This was a great interview, and I really appreciate all of your insights. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Any questions you wish I'd asked? Anything you'd like to talk about?
I think one other thing I just want to say about Oberlin that I maybe seems obvious, but that was really important to me, even though I wasn't directly involved. Oberlin is a great place to be a student because it has both the, you know, college and the conservatory. It has musicians and artists and scientists and, you know, policymakers and the whole gamut of like disciplines all coming together. I have a friend here who's a portrait artist, and she has told me that it's really important to have an artist at the table when you're making big decisions because the way artists' brains work. And I think that's really important that Oberlin has that. We had always had artists at the table and musicians at the table. And that has stuck with me throughout my career, too, is the importance of creativity. Even though I'm not a musician and I'm like one of those people that constantly, oh, you went to Oberlin, what did you play? Oh, I didn't play anything. Right. I'm not a musician at all. but the fact that that was there was really important and continues to be throughout my life. And all my children are musicians. And so I think it's really stuck with me how important it is. I don't know if that's preparing me for the world, but it's making me think about the world differently.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Great. Well, thank you so much again for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much, Nina, for reaching out.
Thanks so much.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye.
You're listening to WOBC Oberlin, 91.5 FM, Oberlin College, and Community Radio. This has been The Weekly. All previously aired episodes of The Weekly are publicly available online. You can listen to them at anchor.fm/theweekly.